Okay, let's get started. Our next discussion will focus on the transparency and governance of audit firms, with more than half of you, 10 out of 17, suggesting that improved transparency and governance of audit firms was one of your top four priorities for the PCAOB to consider. This subject matter is clearly an important one. Many of the topics you brought up reiterated the Treasury Advisory Committee's recommendations. Five of you suggested that firms should be required to have some form of annual financial statements, which was also a recommendation from the Treasury Advisory Committee. Five of you feel that the firm should have independent board members or advisory committees, another recommendation from the Treasury Advisory Committee. Five of you indicated that firms should disclose audit quality indicators. And six of you would have us require the engagement partner signature on audit reports, also a recommendation of the Treasury Advisory Committee. Beyond that, some of you feel that we need to better understand firm structure and competition, strengthen independence rules, as well as review auditor accountability to share owners. Ann Simpson, you stated, the review of auditor accountability to share owners in the U.S. is patchy, and a review of international practice may be useful. Pete, you feel that providing more visibility inside public accounting firms is vital to the investment community given the importance of the audit process to the functioning of our financial system. And Lynn, you are concerned that we require both, quote, the auditor to sign the report, the partner's name, and have the auditors file an annual report with the PCAOB, which includes a report on a list of quality indicators, a set of audited financial statements, much as they do in the UK and elsewhere, a report on their governance, which I believe should include, as the Treasury report recommends, outside directors, close quote. So without further delay, let me turn the discussion over to you, Ann Simpson, Pete Nakhdwe, and Lynn.
Thank you very much. We're going to keep this short and sweet and get us back on track with the timing, I hope. So I want to start by quoting Gandhi, which is a noble thing to do in all circumstances. And he was asked, what did he think about Western civilization? And he said, it would be a good idea. So our topic today is transparency and governance of audit firms. Our panel would like to recommend it would be a good idea. So let's to the details. I think that the items which our chairman has quoted from the ACAP report deserve to be commended and they deserve to be implemented. I just want to focus on a couple of points which I think are really important, and I don't think ACAP really dug into the details. Now, we're assuming that the PCAOB has the big stick. Now, you will talk softly, but you do have a big stick here. But we would like to see, well, certainly CalPERS would like to see, the big stick of regulation reinforced by some market pressures. And the first is to ensure that we have a regime in which the audit firm is ratified by the share owners. If we don't have a model of accountability that's working, we're going to be in great difficulty. And we know, regardless of the resources and the competence and the energy the regulator brings to it, we really do need shareholders to be scrutinising what's put before them on the audit. Now, why don't shareholders particularly care at the moment about the ratification of the auditors? I think because it's just viewed as some form-filling. The structure of the audit market is so concentrated, there is so little choice and so little to understand about the quality of one firm versus the other. I suggest that really what Sharon has been focusing on is the board and the audit committee, which is good. But I think that if more information were to be provided, you would find that the shareholders would buttress what the regulators need to be paying attention to. So financial statements, audited, yes, absolutely. I would also suggest that this needs to be expanded to include governance information, which we require as a matter of routine from companies. So the leadership of the firm, the structure of the corporate affiliations, this is absolutely critical and very relevant to what we were talking about beforehand. I would suggest the idea of independence in the governance structure although I don't know how to put this in a polite way, being British it sounds so disloyal. I mean, the Financial Reporting Council is now requiring from June the 1st the UK part of these tangled webs of spaghetti called audit firms, the UK part will have to produce audited financial statements and will have to report on the extent to which they have independent people involved in the governance of the partnership. Now this seems to me very, very awkward, because these firms are partnerships, and independence only works if you're accountable. And as there are not external capital providers to whom the independent board or executives or non-executives, sorry, can be made accountable, I simply don't see how that will work. And the UK has a wonderful history of window dressing and looking as though we're doing the right thing, and I fear this will head in the same direction. The final point I want to flag up is about some of the other detail in the UK code, which I do think is probably worth looking at, and I'm not going to quote in detail, it's all available on the FRC website. But they've introduced some interesting ideas that audit quality indicators need to be reported upon, which is something the ACAP Committee of Inquiry recommended. But they also would like some parallel provisions to be reported on around risk management and mechanisms like whistleblowing. And I think that if we are continuing to rest the mighty weight of audit upon a handful of opaque, privately owned partnerships which are not disclosing their many and myriad corporate relationships around the world, we really have got a weak link in the governance chain, not just in the US and the UK, which have reasonably well regulated markets, but in many other markets around the world. So, I'll turn over to my esteemed co-panelists, Pete and Lynn.
Thank you, Anne. I wish I had a great Gandhi quote, but we'll have to pass on that for now. But maybe before luncheon, just a couple of thoughts and ideas just to give you a sense of perspective that I bring at this is, in the interest of full disclosure, I spent 27 years at Deloitte, almost 20 of those as a partner. So that's kind of perspective one. But I then have three other perspectives coming from my role at Carlyle since 2007. Two of those are as a client, because we hire the accounting firms to help us do due diligence on companies that we're acquiring. And these are companies that are already audited, generally by a Big Four firm, that we feel the need to go hire another Big Four firm to come in and check what they've done, which is an interesting fact of life. And says something about how audits, again, are conducted and who they're conducted for. And in the second place that we're kind of a client is they audit our firm, they audit our funds, they audit our portfolio companies after we've acquired them. So kind of those three perspectives. And then the last one is probably the reason I'm sitting here, which is as an investor. And so we're relying on, or maybe not relying on, but at least looking at the audits and the financial statements that they've audited of target companies. So with that in mind, I'm going to speak mostly from my last perspective, but want to make sure everybody understands it's informed by a couple of others. And I do think this group and the PCOB in particular can be helpful in promoting some transparency of the audit firms. And I think we have to do it, or PCOB has to do it, being mindful of the fact that they are private. As Anne pointed out, there's some unique challenges to that. They're not only private, they're private partnerships. But having said that, they do have a duty to the public and the society, not just in our country, but elsewhere, have entrusted them with a very important duty to the public, and therefore I think we have a right to demand some transparency, maybe more than we've had in the past. I'll add a few things to what Anne said, and I know Lynn's got some other great ideas, but the three things that I would focus on from a transparency standpoint, in addition to what my fellow panelists are going to say, client acceptance would be one. Second is the global networks, and we talked about those before, but we'll share maybe a couple of ideas there. And then third is on kind of insurance and how they focus on protecting themselves in that regard. But on the client acceptance front, I do think the old adage that all of our parents or some mentor generally taught us in early age is you're known by the company you keep. And certainly Anderson, we can pick on them since they're no longer here, would wish they never kept company with Enron or Sunbeam or Waste Management or WorldCom. And so very often these firms are getting in trouble, not so much because of whether they did a good job auditing or not, but who did they let in the door in terms of the people that they were going to audit. So that would be one issue of understanding how they think about client acceptance. Second piece of that is, who do you decide to retain? Because just because a company was great when you brought them on board doesn't necessarily mean they continue to be great. How do you think about management changes? How do you think about risk and so forth in terms of retaining clients? Corollary to that is, kind of the other end of the pipeline of, they are private businesses that we need to be successful. There's only four of them left. As an investor, we get into a wicked amount of complexity in trying to make sure they're all independent of us, or who can we hire that doesn't have a conflict? And to go down to three firms, I think, would be a bit of a tragedy for our U.S. economy and global economy. How do we help prevent that? One of the ways is they have to have a viable stream of revenues that's going to come from new clients. So this is kind of circular, but it's a very important aspect, I think, of understanding their business model. And in most businesses, a key performance indicator would be, who are the new clients that you let in that year and why, and then who are the ones that maybe you fired. Again, gets into a delicate issue of disclosure. Second, global networks. And we talked a good bit about this, so I'll try not to repeat some of the things we said earlier, but the quality of the affiliates and how they think about that. And I'm intrigued with the idea that, we have the ability, the PCOB has the ability maybe to get at some of the things that foreign regulators don't let us get at by having the big four firms do that, because they already do it. I mean, they spend a lot of time diligencing anybody that's new to the network, I think it's a little less transparent what they do in terms of who they retain in the network. So it's similar to the client acceptance and client retention. You have a similar issue with the global affiliates. And then the last item, insurance, which we don't very often talk about. I think most of the big four at this stage, you used to be insured back when they were the big eight. There was insurance available. I think there's less so today, but there still is insurance. The fact that they have formed a little bit of a kuritsu to try and pass the hat and share liability around amongst the four of them, but I don't think it's well understood. It's a delicate balance, again, in our litigious society, though. Getting it really well understood may just draw a roadmap for the plaintiff's bar. I'll close with a vignette, since I couldn't open with a Gandhi, which is so there's a little bit of tension between accountants and lawyers. So the definition that I grew up with about accountants is, and auditors, is we come in after the battle's lost and bayonet the wounded. But the one step down, I suppose, in the food chain was the lawyers, and I apologize to all the lawyers in the room, but they come in after the accountants and strip the bodies. So the challenge is, if we just simply put a big target up there by having everybody understand their insurance program that should be there to help benefit shareholders or stakeholders that are harmed in a business failure, if all it does is it ends up being one pull on the lottery or on the roulette wheel handle for one set of lawyers in one case, that probably won't do much for the public good. But I think those three areas would be client acceptance, global networks, insurance programs would be interesting.
Yeah. If I recall right, Charlie and Dan, aren't you both an auditor and an attorney?
I tried to insult everybody at once.
Lynn Turner. When the Treasury Committee looked at the accounting profession, some of the issues that Pete raised as well as Ann raised were discussed and, quite frankly, vetted in depth. There were concerns about the governance of the profession, whether they were too internally focused and really getting a useful outside perspective like we see the management teams of public companies able to obtain from their boards. There were issues about financial sustainability and viability that Pete raised with the insurance issues. And there was discussion around the concentration, the fact that we only have four of these firms. And I think at the end of the day, the reality set in that we only got four, and even though some of the other firms down below, Grant Thornton, BDO Seidman, McGladrey, Croces, may do a very fine job, the reality is you could combine all those up and they don't even get to the size of the fourth one. So the reality is we're stuck with these four unless someone decides to go ahead and go in and break them up, and doesn't seem to be any political stomach here in Washington, D.C. So the reality is we've got four. Given that, there's no question it is a major, major systemic risk in the system and something that has to be overseen, has to be wisely dealt with, and needs to be regulated. And from that perspective, it's somewhat surprising, if not even amazing, especially in light of what we've gone through in the focus on risk and what's in the currently pending legislation, that to this day the PCAOB is not getting the fundamental information it needs to manage such a huge systemic risk. And it's a systemic risk to investors, a systemic risk to the public companies and the participants. And there's no question that Sarbanes-Oxley does give you the authority to go get that information. And fundamentally, you have to start with, obviously, your inspections give you a basis for some very useful information. But more importantly, though, it's important that one understands the financial stability of these firms as well. They tend to be lowly capitalized because they're distributing most of the income each year, so partners can pay the taxes, so there's very little capital in them. They use a revolving line of credit financed by the receivables that's paid off each year, so that tees up some leverage issues as well. And they have large, huge pensions to a large degree unfunded. A decade ago on one of them, that number was $9 to $10 billion. It's had to grow exponentially, so it's relatively huge in relation to the revenues of the firms as well. As partners have described it to me, it's their version of the Ponzi scheme, because they're using the current earnings to pay the retirements of the old partners, and the young partners who are paying for it just hope they're able to get old and retire and get paid before it that becomes bigger. So in light of that, it is important that the PCAOB start getting the information that one has to have to manage such a significant systemic risk, which would include items that have already been discussed. I think it starts with some of the information we find the motherland, quite frankly, requires in the annual report from their large firms. They require an annual report. They require it be audited and it be made publicly available. You would tag on to that the things that Ann recommended then, a discussion about the governance, a discussion about the structure of the firm, discussing the affiliate notion, because they are clearly just affiliates. And as we've seen in court case after court case now, every time there's a case brought and the shareholders try to reach out to one of the affiliates, the firms make it very clear and make a very clear argument in each court case that they have nothing to do with one another, they don't oversee one another, they don't set their audit quality standards whatsoever. You can look at any of these court documents in any of the court cases and you'll see the same arguments being made time and time again. So it's important that you learn and understand the structure in that annual report. There should be the annual audited financial statements, just as they do in the UK. The point about client acceptance is so important, and how they go through that client acceptance, because we found, as we did with Anderson and as Pete appropriately noted time and time again, people, while they tell us they've got great client acceptance standards, it seems always if the fee's big enough, people go for it. We've recently seen the case where one firm been doing the audit for $4 million, or another one has now come in and picked that audit up for $1 million, which raises a serious question here. And we should also have disclosure in there about key metrics in terms of quality control factors. It's another thing that the ACAP took up, principally because of a recommendation from a former retired Big Four partner that I think put forward some excellent recommendations and had focused on the right type of quality control factors. That goes beyond what's in the EU 8th Directive, which I think is a good starting point, but it's only that. The EU Directive is only a starting point, and there needs to be... You cannot manage such a grave systemic risk if all you're getting is what's in the EU 8th Directive. I also think that it's important that from an investor perspective, we talk a little bit about a regulator perspective, investors now are given the chance to vote on these auditors the majority of the times on an annual basis. And we need to make sure that we give the investors the information to make an informed decision if we're going to ask them, and in fact they want to be able to vote on them. So we need to make sure that not only we're getting this annual report out there, but we also want to know who is the audit partner that we're voting on. And in many foreign countries, France, UK, elsewhere, they tell us not only who the firm is, and that's important because the firm's behind the audit report and sets overall quality control standards, but it's equally important, I've always believed, that your audit is only as good as your audit partner. And we're entitled as investors to know who is that audit partner that's doing the audit for us. And some people have complained, well, if I do that, it'll increase my liability. That's absolutely false and a misnomer. By signing your name, you don't change your liability one iota. And the firms have said here in the U.S., oh, we don't want to do the public report like they do in the U.K. because people will be able to see our finances and people sue us more often or something. But that's absolutely a misnomer. In any of these court cases, the court always ultimately admits the financial statements of the firm anyway, so they get them regardless. So that's a kind of a Chicken Little running around the sky is falling type argument that just doesn't hold water whatsoever. So there's, in light of the systemic risk and in light of the investors wanting to vote on this important decision to them, it is key that we get much more transparent, that the PCAOB gets that transparent information. I fear for the PCAOB, again, if you had a problem with one of these major firms and you hadn't even been getting the financial statements on that firm, what would your defense be to the public about how you regulated risk? You couldn't even or didn't even get a financial statement that showed on a real GAAP basis what this thing really looked like with all those pension obligations and liabilities. And I don't think there's going to be any answer that would save you on the front page of a New York Times. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, there are a large number of categories of issues there. I think we could start with any number of different questions. I don't know who wants to open it up. I've got some, but Tony, we're here to get your input. So,
well, I was just wondering what type of information about the audit firm's risk assessments do you get today? And what is it that you could ask for? Because I've asked audit firms on how they make those decisions, and as Lynn pointed out, when you replace an audit firm that was conducting your audit for $4 million with somebody who was conducting it for $1 million, as an investor, I'd like to know which one of those was wrong. I don't think it's obvious directionally by just looking at that number. But I have also asked audit firms about what they do, and I think things may have changed today, but for a long time, I don't think they were conducting anything that one could call as worthwhile risk analysis to determine which audits, which clients they should take. And I think the systemic risk of fundamentally the principle that the three of you have told us is that it's too few to fail. And it seems just as bad as the too big to fail. And I think both of them ought to be permitted to do so, because otherwise the risk for the rest of us is rather significant. So the other thing I was wondering about, those recent audit firm that had issues with Bally Fitness, for example, and they've been asked to hire an outside consultant to tell them whether they're doing a reasonable job of their internal controls and those kinds of things, and how they take information up to the technical, to the national office and so on. And I was intrigued. I said, I wonder who's going to be competent enough to do that sort of analysis. And, you know, but not a word has been heard of that since. I suspect there's something going on there. But that's the kind of thing that I think it would be worth getting additional information on and being able to do something in order to protect the investors and, in effect, to be able to do your job in your case.
You said that providing more visibility to key aspects of interest to the public inside public accounting firms is vital to the investment community, given the importance of the audit process to the functioning of our financial system. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the types of financial information about a public accounting firm that you think is needed.
Well, I think, you know, Lynn hit on one aspect is the, you know, the pension liability. There is some overhang for that, and how do firms manage that? It generally is unfunded. I think in all cases it's unfunded, in part because there are tax rules that don't allow them to get a deduction, and ERISA doesn't allow you to have an ERISA protected plan for a partnership. So therefore they tend to, you know, have these unfunded liabilities. But how do you deal with the fact that, you know, there is that overhang, and it creates such an amount of overhang for the younger partners in terms of being able to operate the firm viably? I generally think from my prior experiences that, or at least my own experience with one firm, is that it's well managed, but, you know, I don't know that for sure for the other three firms. Another aspect is just simple, you know, basic blocking and tackling. Are they able to, you know, kind of manage the balance sheet and, you know, make sure that, number one, they have adequate liquidity to operate the business, that they're not having trouble with clients in terms of being able to pay their bills and operate the business, and are they keeping an appropriate amount of reserve? As Lynn said, you know, for tax reasons, you generally tend to, tax and other reasons, you generally pay out all the earnings of the firm on an annual basis, but what are you saving? These are multi-billion dollar enterprises. You know, how conservative or aggressive are they being in terms of managing the balance sheet and keeping some sort of liquidity reserve? So those would be the things I would focus on. I don't know if my panelists have anything to add there.
Sorry, I'm actually sharing Pete's question, so I should be on his microphone. I just wondered if you'd say a bit more about this insurance issue, because it seems to be at the root of much evil, or certainly much of the problem that we're tackling here, because the introduction of limited liability for the joint stock company was, in a sense, you know, what set capitalism running free. And the fact that we have this partnership structure and reliance on insurance seems to me you've got a whole model where you've embedded risk aversion into the system at a time when you actually need auditors to be bold, to be creative, to be investigative. How much can insurance solve that problem? Or, you know, how are we going to deal with, the perverse consequences of unlimited liability? I mean, it sounds like a good way of holding their feet to the fire, but then they just, you know, don't want to be anywhere near it.
The liability is probably made bigger in the press media than what it really is. I mean, it's a concern to firms, and you're always worried about the one lawsuit that might bring you down. But on the other hand, the partnership structure does keep skin in the game, which keeps people's attention. The one situation where we've had a gatekeeper in a corporate structure is credit rating agencies. They didn't have skin in the game, so to speak, and we saw that the corporate structure drove nothing but a bottom-line mentality, and for a gatekeeper, it certainly didn't work. So the partnership structure, I don't think, is the problem. It does keep people focused on, I think, to a large degree, the right things. On the liability issue, shareholders have never brought down one of the big firms.
Shareholders have always negotiated to a settlement. The largest settlement was against Ernst & Young with Cendant, and even there, Lazar Fair was brought in. They examined what the viability of the firm was and its ability to pay and came up with a number, and the shareholder, which was actually TIA Cref at the time, agreed to a reasonable number. The only place we've got into a situation where you've had the possibility of a firm failing is where the government itself was instituting a penalty, such as we saw on Anderson, or in the early 1990s out of the S&L crisis, the Fed came close to imposing a fine on two firms, KPMG and EY, that would have failed both of them. And at the time, the head of the GAO stepped in and was able to talk the Fed into taking a lower number that would allow both firms to survive. So it hasn't been an issue with shareholders. And in fact, today, the largest lawsuits often are not from shareholders. They're from other companies or the corporations themselves suing the investors. So, but everyone seems to understand that at the end of the day, you don't want to put one of these firms down. I don't see a shareholder ever putting one of the big four firms down at this point. So as long as the government is acting in a responsible fashion and there's reasonable governance and oversight over the firms, so they're not doing things like what KPMG was doing with the tax shelters, I can't imagine an outside board stepping in a situation like KPMG where they were selling the tax shelters and actually had discussions about the fact that they could make so much more money than any of the fines would ever be that they ought to go ahead and do it. You just aren't going to see that. So if you can get good governance in them, I think that solves a lot of the insurance issue or concern. And then it's just up to the PCAOB. They could always get information on the insurance and request that. And that, along with the financial statements, would give them some flavors to where you're getting into an untenable situation.
Norman, I know that you raised, in terms of your priorities, some market structure and concentration issues. I don't know whether you want to talk about that here whatever.
No, I think it's probably a good time. I'll be brief because I know there are many, many others at the table who have views on the subject as well. But I think there is a broader issue here about market structure that I hope at some point in the work of this group we'll have a chance to discuss and maybe have some thoughts on. It's been discussed in other contexts, but generally results in a general proposal to give it further consideration and see if there isn't some way to change the way in which this profession is capitalized, in essence, because that, I think, is what we're talking about here. We have we used to have, not all that many years ago, a Big Ten who became a Big Five, now a Big Four, but became a Big Five through a series of mergers and accumulated economies of scale in that process, and that is when the industry really bifurcated, I think, and there's a tremendous bridge to cross, and I think perhaps an uncrossable barrier now between the Big Four and those who comprise the rest of the industry, and it has primarily to do with capital. I mean, the key to being a Big Four and being competitive as a Big Four firm is the global presence, which we talked about in the earlier context, having the need to have industry and subject matter expertise across a vast array of areas, and IT infrastructure and a lot of capital expenditures involved to maintain an enterprise of that nature. And as Lynn has and Pete have so well noted, these are partnerships at the end of the day, and there is something perhaps of a disconnect between the manner in which a partnership enterprise manages its balance sheet and the way the enterprise needs to function, the financial resources it needs to have at its disposal. So one thing I hope we'll have a chance to talk about, if not today and at another time, is whether and how to introduce the possibility, and it may be that it falls here with the PCAOB, but there'll be a lot of other interested parties and stakeholders, but the possibility that public accounting firms be permitted or encouraged to organize in corporate form and raise capital, as corporations do, from third parties, from outside sources, strengthen their balance sheet, provide a cushion that clearly doesn't exist today, and perhaps through that process to provide opportunities for other providers to become more competitive. I think there's an issue there that really requires some serious consideration.
Damon Silvers.
Yeah. mean, like Lynn, I was a participant in the Treasury panel that had a number of recommendations and engaged in very extensive discussions on these issues. I think there's a couple of takeaways from that process that broadly that I think are important. I don't think it's a panacea, and this again may go to some other people's comments, but I think putting some independent voices into the firm governance certainly would be an improvement in our major audit firms. Secondly, I think that having financial statements and having those statements accessible to the board and accessible to investors, it just seems kind of like common sense to me. I think the notion that these institutions are private entities in any meaningful sense is absurd. Effectively, the way we discuss the systemic risks associated with the failure of any given one of them tells us that they're really no longer private entities in any meaningful way. And therefore, the notion that their financials should be secret seems to me indefensible. That being said, I'm not sure I fully agree with Lynn that the financials of the audit firms are that important. The fact that their secrecy is indefensible doesn't necessarily mean that you really learn that much important from them. As Lynn alluded to, Arthur Andersen collapsed not because a giant liability appeared on his balance sheet, but because all its clients ran away when it got indicted. And I think that tells us something about what audit firms really are, which is not a collection of financial assets in any meaningful sense, but a reputation and a collection of human capital. That being said, the private litigation system in relation to audit firms does fulfill a limited but useful function, which is one of kind of deterrence. And I think there's lots of evidence over the years that private litigants, for better or for worse, are very measured in relation to their demands on audit firms, with the occasional exception of the sort of non-traditional party, the sort of business actor looking to score a giant score in some one-off situation. The final observation I make about these matters, about governance matters, is that I'm deeply skeptical. In fact, I would say more than skeptical, outright opposed to converting audit firms as partnerships into public corporations or into the corporate form. There's a lot of debate right now about whether, in fact, our stock brokerages, our investment banks, were pushed significantly in the direction of our current financial disaster as a result of their conversion from partnerships to public corporations. I think while the two entities are very different, I think there's something sort of going on behind there, which is that the partnership and the sort of the thinness of the distance between the institution and the individual professionals involved in it is a structure that in some ways is an attempt to embody the notion that this is a professional association and not a profit maximizing enterprise at some level. I'm not suggesting that's exactly how these firms were always managed. But it embodies an aspiration I think it's very dangerous to walk away from, and I'm certain that we would not obtain the public goods that we are essentially asking audit firms to deliver were they to be organized as private profit maximizing enterprises.
Joe Curcello.
A couple of points. I wanted to briefly respond to Tony's point about the $4 million audit fee and the $1 million audit fee, and kind of like to know which one was right. I don't know if you'll ever know unequivocally which one was right, but for the benefit of the investors in the room, I have a suggestion. It may not be a great use of your time, but you can run CompuStat on size and industry, And if most of the companies in the same industry at the same, approximately the same size, are at 4 million, then you probably have your answer, right? If most of them are at 1 million, you probably have your answer. It's not perfect, but you could get a rough approximation based on public data, and that's one of the benefits of the SEC's rule, I guess, probably when you were there, Lynn, with Arthur, that disclosure, which I think is very valuable. There was a brief discussion earlier about transparency reports. I think Ann Simpson mentioned it. I would point out that, and I think it's to their credit, I don't know if the SEC and the PCAOB have seen it, but Deloitte has voluntarily published a transparency report this year. It's the only big four firm in the United States that have done that. I'm sure there's always room for improvement, but it's their first shot, and they did it voluntarily, and I think they need to be publicly praised for that. In terms of some of the things we've discussed, I would reinforce those who have spoken in favor of audit quality indicators. I think the motivation behind that at ACAP is right on target. If you have, and I would not recommend one, because if you have one indicator, the firms will just manage to that indicator. But if you have a series of indicators, 10, 15, 20, and no one indicator is going to be perfect, but I think you could come up with a series of indicators that most people would say are at least directionally consistent with improving audit quality. And if you had those and you annually published some portion of them, not all 20 every year, so the firms would not know which ones you're going to publish, sort of like SAS 99 introduce an element of unpredictability. So you publish some of them every year. The firms will pay attention to those, and to the extent they're good proxies for audit quality, will work to improve their firm's performance on those measures because it'll be public. I think I remember Damon talking about this. I believe it was Damon. In the New York Times, pick it up, or Forbes, fix it up, or Fortune, Business Week, whatever. Audit committees will look at it, and it will affect hiring behavior, so it'll affect firm behavior. I can speak directly to this. I've seen what this does in universities, these university rankings, which are ubiquitous. And let me tell you guys, provosts, chancellors, deans, parents, students, for all of their warts, and there's lots of warts associated with them, they pay attention to them. And it does affect odd behavior inside universities. And unlike big four accounting firms, which may gain and lose clients, at the end of the day, we're a state-supported university where, you know, we're going to get a certain percentage of the kids from the state of Tennessee regardless of how we do in those rankings. But it, even with that said, it affects our behavior, so I'm sure it would affect the behavior of the major accounting firms. Independent members on firm governing boards, I think, is a great idea. I think Ann talked about how it could be gamed in the U.K. I think Lynn has, in his written statement, not sure how effective this would be. The danger is you have independent members on firm governing boards who are independent. They're not part of the firm, but they're friendly to the senior management of the firm. That's the risk you have with corporations today, right? Social networks. Commissioner Glassman, when she was still at the SEC, talked about the risk of social networks. I think that's a very real risk. And so what I would suggest, if the board did go in this direction, that they would put in place that firms have independent members on firm governing boards, but that those independent members would select their replacements, so that over time you reduce the influence of management on who are the independent members. It may take a while to get completely independent members on the boards, but I think it'd have some effect. And then I think the audit partner's signature recommendation is a good recommendation as well, but I've spoken long enough.
Actually, let me turn to Judge Sporkin for one second, because, Judge, I know that you recommended independent advisory boards as well, and Joe, and you pointed out as a priority, and maybe you can speak for a second on that, and then we'll turn to the others.
I recommended independent advisory boards to the...
Yeah, but you're talking now about the Arthur Andersen that started some time back. I think it's very important that there be audit firms get ventilated. I found that they are much too closed. They need to have, when they have a blown audit, they need to have some independent to look at the blown audit and to find out what went wrong, what lessons are learned, and to make changes. Anderson, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but back in the, was it 70s or so, my 70s, Dan, you might remember this, appointed an independent board, including Newt Minow, and some other former chairman of the SEC, and some other people, and it worked out well. And you see what happens when they abandon it. But there are other reasons for that. But the point is that you need the you need to open it up. You have to. They need to have someone outside that they can converse with, and to be able to, you know, give them good advice. And it will work. Does anybody have it now? Any of the firms have it now? None? And then why did they abandon the...
Actually, Lynn, before we get to answering the judges, because we're a little bit behind schedule.
Right.
Kelvin, why don't we go to you, Gus, and Tony? And then if you've got an, we can think about that. If you've got an answer, then you can answer the judge.
It's Kelvin Blake. I just wanted to say that I agree with Norman Harrison that we need to figure out some way to remove the barriers of these regional firms moving up to become the top five or the top six accounting firms. However, I agree with Damon that I don't know that we want to necessarily go the corporate route, because when you go the corporate route, the audit firm will then have a responsibility or a primary duty to the shareholders, and that duty would be to maximize profit. And my concern that is if the audit firm has to balance, you know, audit quality with maximizing profit, it may lead to a reduction in audit quality.